Hi there.
How are we? Welcome to an 8:30 BitCon meeting. And we're going to talk about the collapse of Mt. Gox. Well, I have other names that I call them, but that's beside the point. Bitcom is a virtual currency. Bitcom is still being used. Bitcom will probably be used for at least another 2 to 3 to 4 years. There are other virtual currencies out there. I'm not saying that Bitcom will cease in 4 years. It's just that I think that it's going to be...
Bitcoin?
Yes, Bitcoin. Yes. Go over there. Back. But we're going to talk about the collapse of Mt. Gox. And pretty much, there have been a lot of theories behind it. I have a background also in forensic accounting, and we're going to talk about a couple of these interesting theories, and then we're going to go into questions. There is one question that was asked to me before at a lunch table, and the U.S. government and actually the world governments have all determined that if you lost money in the Bitcoin collapse, you are allowed to deduct that on your tax returns. My statement to the person was, just realize if you deduct it, then the government has the ability to ask, where did it come from? And how did you make it? And not that I would say that anyone here would not declare 100% of how they made their money and pay taxes to it, but if you do deduct it, realize you're opening that Pandora's box. There have been a batch of theories about how the collapse came about or how they lost $470 million. One of the theories is transaction malleability. I'm going to give a very brief description of. It's pretty much, as it was explained to me, it's pretty much you write a check, and in the check, the data line, which says your account, your routing number and such, is not present. And you have the ability to capture that data, fix that data, and amend it. That transaction then gets closed, and then you basically contact the institution through customer service and say, it didn't go through, and you need to reissue that amount of bitcoins. There is no question that there were a lot of bad transactions that went through. I mean, their customer service and their internal security in the Japanese bankruptcy court has already stated that that's true. The issue is that based on all the studies, pretty much their statement is it's probably that cost them about $5 million. The reason is not that they couldn't capture bad data and bad transactions because they were all over the map. The issue was for them to get it reissued so that they could get a second tranche of this money is they had to call customer service because once the transaction was done from every point of view, it was a closed transaction on all the miners. So it was closed. So they had to call up Gox and say, hi, it's a bad transaction. We never got our money. You need to reissue it. They go into their wallet, the wallet that's basically been closed up, and they have to open it up and reissue it. So the statement was, okay, maybe 6% of the total amount went out. To say that the entire amount, which was the original theory, went out, never met the test, especially since the logs were published recently. Somebody hacked and put it in there. So they hacked his logs. I mean, God. Now, one of the issues that was brought up when this was brought up was that there were two individuals, Wiley and Marcus, who basically were users at the institution. And the problem was that Wiley started buying bitcoins, never was charged a transaction fee, and nobody knows if they ever paid money, but they kept buying coins. This started to begin in, Wiley was about August of 2013. And he had a great concept. He was buying 10 coins, 20 coins, 30 coins, 50 coins every 3 minutes. Every 3 minutes, the log shows this transaction went through. He wasn't selling, he was only buying. Now, everyone, I think, remembers that August, all of a sudden, the price of Bitcoin started to skyrocket. I think last year, when we did this, Bitcoin was at about $100. I think I think people would know better than mine, but I think December, January, Bitcoin was close to 1,000. And the issue that was brought was that because of Wiley, who'd never had to pay anything, but because of the scarcity and constant hitting, and everything's done by a market, that the price basically was inflated at Mount. Wiley all of a sudden disappeared, which was okay. The other problem was, though, Marcus, 5 days later, showed up, who was using the same account and using everything. And both Wiley and Marcus, basically, in your Bitcoin account, it states your country, let's say Japan, New York, United States. Neither one of them had country codes. Neither one of them had city codes. Neither one of them had supposedly correct IPs, which is now what is being said. And he kept the purchasing up to maintain the price until about February, March, when the announcement was made. Hi, we lost, I think it was 800 and some odd thousand bitcoins, price of $470 million at that time. And the price, and what happened was when they stopped, when Marcus stopped, the price started to adjust down. So one of the issues was, well, they're hackers. They were able to hack the system. Well, now, and I know that we do a hacking course here, and I hope there are no hackers here that might take offense at this. I don't really think so. The reason being is they've already stated that it was not a server hack. It was every person that has bitcoins has their own wallet. That basically someone hacked and got hold of all these keys to the wallet and pulled the bitcoins out. There's a minor problem to that, very small. And nobody that's been a hacker can tell me how you can do this. All the keys are always kept offline. So if all the keys are kept offline, and trust me, I know a lot of hackers. They are great people. They are great partiers. They cannot explain to me how they can hack something that's offline yet. And we're not talking about, where you basically, we have the key punch memory. No. These are all kept offline. So from a hacking perspective, not really. It doesn't make it. From a transaction malleability, okay, yeah, you got $5, $6 million at best. And that's fine. So it's not the lost keys, which were the hack. Oh, well, the lost keys is a better story. And these are all from the president, by the way. The president put this out on the web. Who was supposedly a software genius, but pretty much he worked and wrote really terrible protection software, obviously, because he lost $470 million. But the statement was that one day, and we're in DragonCon, so we can talk about fantasy. One day, the people at Mt. Gox woke up, and all the keys were gone. They had misplaced the keys. There were no more keys. And so they scurried around, looking like for Easter eggs. Where are the missing keys? If you believe that, I can sell you the Brooklyn Bridge. You know, you can't lose the keys. And they said they couldn't get into the keys. Now, again, I rely on some of my hacker friends who basically sat there and laughed their heads off, because they sat there and said, there are programs that they could have just put in, and these are not heavy encryption keys, that they could have sat there and basically said, here's our key, here's our little file, here's your lock, yeah, we'll figure out a way, it'll take maybe 2 hours, 3 hours, we'll give you new keys. So, but that was the new, that was one of the bigger theories, the lost key theory, which I thought was kind of fun. Then we have the best one. I like this one. It was brought up by, again, the president, that he believed that it's possibly that the U.S. government decided to basically get in there and take the coins without his knowledge. Now, understand how this has got to run. The U.S. government, and I, by the way, I don't put it past the U.S. government if they could have done it. Okay, so we're not talking that. But the U.S. government would have had to get a subpoena quietly, which they can do, would have had to issue the subpoena to the Japanese government. The Japanese government would have then had to agree to the subpoena, would have had to, the Japanese government and the U.S. government would have had to go in to grab all the information, the virtual currency, out of the servers. Wait, I'll be there. We're not there yet. Out of the servers with no one knowing it. Because, you know, and then basically transmit it all back to the U.S. government where it would sit. And not anyone in the government of Japan or the U.S. has said a word about this. Yes?
Sorry, could you use one of our microphones?
Sorry. No, he's down here.
Okay.
Yeah. You don't look like the oldest daughter, by the way.
Your IPs on military bases, depending on where you are, which military base you're on, are still registered to your the country that you're in.
Right.
So you wouldn't necessarily need to subpoena the Japanese government to get the
servers. Were all in Japan.
The servers were physically in Japan?
Yes.
Yes. Oh, okay. Well, yeah. That's
fine. But no, I would agree with you. If the servers were cloud, let's call it cloud for a commentary, or not in Japan,
Yeah. Your
statement would be more accurate. But the servers were in Japan. The physical essence that's there in Japan, you got to help. You got to not subpoena the Japanese government. Let's not get emotional here. I mean, the U.S. government would have had to ask for the help of the Japanese government.
Or of a citizen.
Right. Well, it wasn't just the U.S. bank. No, you see, it would have been the U.S. government, and that's the other fallacy. The U.S. government has jurisdiction over U.S. citizens and over U.S. citizens' accounts. The $470 million was not just U.S. Okay. So, even though people have brought to me, you know, you're going to have to talk about the U.S. government and how they colluded with the Japanese government. And I said, yeah, you know, we could bring in the Egyptian government. We can bring in, you know, the Chinese government. So, I don't, you know, but I wanted to cover it because it has been brought up as an issue. So they did not, I mean, the interesting thing that everybody has told me is if they had admitted that the servers had been hacked, that would have been a very good possibility, and it would have been the number one reason how this could have really happened, this amount of money disappearing, ignoring good old Wiley and Marcus over there, who we'll get back to in a moment. But they have adamantly denied the server was not hacked. All right. And the reason why I wanted to get back to Wiley and Marcus is that there are some people that have traced Wiley to the president. of Mt. Gox, you know. So their statement is, this is the alter ego of the president, the CEO, and he is the alter ego of him, i.e. the alter ego of the CEO. No one has brought up embezzlement by the CEO, which from an accounting forensic is like, you look for the for this type of transaction, you look for the insider. You don't look to the outside. So some of the other things that happened that are kind of interesting. Last year we were talking about that, I think it was U.S. Coin was suing Mount because the U.S. Treasury Department stated you had 90 days to get your dollar exchange to become an exchange rate, and the U.S. Treasury has determined that virtual currency is a currency. Now, Bitcoin basically stated they are not a currency for the Department of Treasury to regulate. That's the Bitcoin Foundation has stated that. The U.S. Treasury has said that they are. I don't know why, but the U.S. Treasury won in that case. And no exchange licenses were ever applied for. So the entity that was handling all the U.S. transactions in the U.S., first of all, the U.S. Department of Treasury took $5 million and basically grabbed it because they were in violation. And then Mt. Gox was sued for $75 million for damages by the U.S. entity. Now, I don't know how many people have ever gotten into litigation in the United States because they were sued in the United States. But and understand, I've unfortunately dealt with a lot of litigation, so I'm kind of amazed. And here's my amazement, and it's hard to really amaze me at this point in my life, is that the lawsuit was filed. The court date had not come about. They had 60 days to file an answer. Would you believe within 90 days of the filing of the lawsuit, $75 million was paid out to settle the lawsuit, dollar for dollar, no litigation. Personally, I wish I knew their lawyers. I mean, I can't get a hold of their lawyers because, I mean, that's a miracle in U.S. litigation purposes. Bitcoin traders, the U.S., started a class action suit, basically screaming embezzlement, theft, everything under the sun. It was like, from my knowledge, in April, they settled. They settled basically with the statement of, we will rely upon the Japanese court, and we are releasing all claims against all executives. The collapse pretty much is when you have an entity that loses $470 million, you have no liquidity. They couldn't cover the calls. They stopped. People were trying to sell their coins for cash. They could not get the cash. Why? They had no cash left. They also were trying to get their coins out. Well, they had a problem because I think it was 850,000 coins were missing. So everything got frozen. The company collapsed. Actually, they immediately went into bankruptcy receivership. Some of the strange things that happened during this period was there were certain people that were very well known in solving hacking. They were investigative hackers. Three of them contacted and asked, would you like us to come and solve your problems and close your security holes and then maybe see what to do? And this offer, by the way, was made also back in 2011, early 2011, when the same situation had happened. And these guys were actually brought over and everything. I think you guys might remember there were like 3 or 4 days that the, you know, the exchange went off. And then it went back on. They had to go off because they got hacked. I mean, it wasn't a Bitcoin, you know, fundamental transaction hack. It was a hack. They got hacked. They got down for 4 days. These guys came over. They fixed it. They plugged the security holes. But that was 2011. Late 2013, 2014, same problem. These same guys came in, said, hi, do you want us to come over again? He said, absolutely not. There's no need to come out. We're going to get into questions. I mean, can I tell you definitively who took the coins? No. Can I tell you losing $470 million from an accountant's perspective without any... I mean, how do you lose $470 million that this started? I mean, fundamental transaction is, I start with these many Bitcoins, I get these many Bitcoins in, I get these many Bitcoins out, this is my ending amount of Bitcoins, I total up everything in the wallets, and I have a dollar amount, and I got my beginning dollar, and I converted my debt, and I got a deviation of something. I don't have a deviation of $470 million in one day, you know? When it starts getting there, you basically sit there and say, I have a problem. Let's fix the problem. Nobody fixed the problem. And what has happened is that along with this, we'll mention what other entity. There was also an entity called, it was kind of two of them. I like this one. I thought you guys would have much more fun if we talked about this. Silk Road and Silk Road 2.0, which kind of was like Silk Road and then child of Silk Road. And Silk Road basically was, you know, it was they used an encryption that we talked about last year. It was called Tor, which basically Tor created anonymity so you cannot be traced. And it was great. And Tor basically said, you know, we're not there for that reason. We're just here for an encryption program. But Silk Road basically, if you went onto Silk Road and you had to use Bitcoins, you could buy or sell drugs. I mean, it was great. You know, buy or sell drugs anywhere in the world. You could, there was prostitution on this. And there was also a very interesting allegation that you could actually go in and do a murder for hire. You know, every time I've tried to find out, okay, show me the exact murder for hire, you know, it says, well, we know about it. It's there. And I'm sitting there going, yeah, but it's nowhere else other than from you who says it to you, who basically gets quoted by you to you. But what ended up happening was, in that one, which was kind of humorous, the Department of Treasury spent, I think, 811 bitcoins to buy drugs. And they got the drugs, by the way. They got their drugs. They had their 811 bitcoins. And then basically went in and basically grabbed the servers, closed everything down. I think they got, $32,716,283 bitcoins from, you know, Silk Road. And I'm going to bring back why we're talking about Silk Road. Silk Road basically was created. The person that basically was running it got convicted. Well, he's not convicted. He was arrested. His argument was that bitcoins are not a currency, so therefore, you can't arrest me because, you know, I was not getting money for drugs. I was getting this virtual currency. The judge ruled against him and said, well, yeah, but you could take the virtual currency and turn it into dollars, so who cares? But child of Silk Road was created, and it was promised that if the government closed us down, we are in such a position that our administrators could give a period of time, go in, and recreate Silk Road. Silk Road pretty much in November stated they got hacked. They only lost 2.7 million bitcoins. They pretty much were just closed out. They gave up. Then you got Child of Silk Road, which really was called Project Black Flag. Project Black Flag, I know this is going to be shocking to everyone, also lost about 5 million bitcoins. And then basically Child of Child of Child, called Black Market, officially went off the web. They are now, nobody knows where they are. But what I'm trying to kind of show you is a lot of the exchanges that are being used are quietly being closed down. Not by the government, but because pretty much their statement is, we've been hacked, you've lost your coins. Now, there is a demographic that people that own bitcoins that 85% of them are people within the 20 to 35 year range. They also say of that range, only 5% manage their own wallet, that all the other wallets are on exchanges and being managed by the exchanges. I mean, I'm not a big person in regards to banks, but at least my money's insured. You know, I have no problem people speculating in Bitcoin. Some people made a lot of money. The whole issue that you need is you don't put your life savings into something that you can't basically guarantee that the person that's basically holding your keys isn't going to steal from you. We're open for questions. Oh, come on. I was told you were going to be running around. Okay. Pick one. It doesn't matter.
You were talking about, you know, noticing a $500 million... $470 million blank spot in your deposits, but is it possible that they were just another victim of the bubble of Bitcoin? Like the fact that there were all these artificially inflated prices for the currency that were producing massive, massive higher returns, and that it just wasn't something that was calculated. Like with the gold sellers or anyone else in any of the commodities that have gone through similar busts in, you know, the past 5 years.
Well, in that regard, first of all, if we talk about commodities, right, ignoring the government regulation of them, okay, any commodity dealer knows how many coins they have, how much gold ounces they have, at the beginning of the day, how much they have, and the currency fluctuation or the price fluctuation is easily calculable. I mean, I could ask you today, I could ask you right now, okay, what's the price of Bitcoin now? And somebody here could Google it and come up with the price within, depending on your internet connection, maybe a minute and a half. Okay, so all these fluctuations in price, the money going up, the money going down, is easily accounted for.
Well, were the people that were running Mt. Gox, did they have any sort of financial background at all, or was it just people that were familiar with the software?
Well, they were familiar with their own software, not with Bitcoin software. Okay, that's one thing. The issue, though, is that they have been, if they can sit there and say, we lost $470 million, right? They had to have some accounting process there to say, because how they calculate it? Or we lost 825,000, and I'm being round here. They have it to the actual. We lost 825, I think it's 1,000 bitcoins. Okay, so it's not an accounting process, and God forbid that if it was an accounting process, then I really feel really worried for people that had put their money in there. You know, because theoretically, they would never know what was in their wallets. But they're cold wallets. The keys have to be used to open the wallet to take them out and to close it. If you can't, if they, how did somebody get the keys to open and take the money out? That's the real question. You're taking back the cube.
Yes.
Oh, okay. It moved to a different person. I thought you were absconding with the cube. Yes.
Okay, so this occurred, I guess, in January, February-ish, right, of this year, right?
February 14th is when they filed in Japanese court for bankruptcy.
Well, I have an article here from Trilema that's dated April 8th, 2013, and he said that essentially that there was evidence of them trading on fractional reserve because they have gotten hacked so many times previously. So could it have been that maybe that they were just a scam to begin with, and that maybe that it was all fraudulent?
The U.S. class action suit claimed embezzlement and fraud. They were one of the largest translators. Could it have been always a fraud? Yes. Is it being looked at? No. Okay. I'm restrained by what factually happened, kind of. I mean, I can project a lot of things, but based on losing $470 million, my first inclination is this is something that's in-house, because that's really the only way to do this. And if it's in-house, then my thought is either internal theft or embezzlement. Or, as you said, it could have been a fraudulent transaction from the beginning of time. I kind of like the cube. It kind of like you can toss. It's like a Nerf ball.
Maybe I'm missing it. Maybe I don't know enough about the system. But is either the Bitcoin or the transactions are serialized or hashed? I mean, you have the system is set
the
up.
The transactions are hashed.
Okay, then if the transactions are hashed and the network, the Bitcoin network, is keeping track of how many coins are mined and how many coins are in circulation until they hit the finite number set at the end of the system, then how could 800,000 Bitcoins or whatever, widgets, how could they disappear if you're in a closed network where all the transactions are hashed? I mean, maybe the value could fall, but how do those numerical values disappear?
Okay, forget the 6%, which we know went because pretty much of incorrect data transaction, incorrect hashing, okay? Here's where if you have coins that are being bought and sold and no money is being in any way, shape, or form transacted or translated, then they're not keeping track of the actual coins itself. And the miners are being told, the miners who are really were the first line of security, okay, are being told, okay, 50 bitcoins went out and it was $50,000. Okay, so every miner basically takes 50 off and moves it to a different account. The problem was the $50,000 never was put into any account. So it's like taking a product, virtual currency, and not paying for it. And it kept disappearing. And nobody was tracking the disappearance of the currency. And what was happening was every miner thought that there was these 850,000 bitcoins in a certain place, and they were not there.
So then has the theoretical number of bitcoins decreased in the system?
No. Same number. Now they're missing. But not during, now they can't find the 850. But the numerical, if you went to the Bitcoin Foundation and said, how many are in circulation? Their number has not changed. They have not subtracted out 850,000. They're saying it's somewhere out there. But it hasn't been a deletion within the foundation of how many coins were supposed to be there. Who has the box?
I've got it.
Well, it's virtual currency. There's no ID number on it. No, the ones that are gone, suppose, the ones that are gone, okay? They're saying that there is no ID on these. Supposed to have an identifier. Yeah. Right, they don't.
Okay, so judging from the verbiage that that has been used and the estimate of kind of the sunsetting of this amount of activity with Bitcoins, I'm inferring that you're generally not necessarily opposed to it, but skeptical of the process. And is there, outside of the fact that there are these apparently fraudulent businesses centered around taking your Bitcoins, holding them, and saying, oh, sorry, we lost them.
Right.
Outside of that, are there any other tenets that you would point out as failures of the system, which will inevitably lead to its downfall?
Bitcoin did have a security problem that was identified, and supposedly Bitcoin Foundation has been working to fix that security problem. I do not know if the security problem has been fixed or not. The gentleman here is saying, no, it hasn't, so we'll go under that.
Okay.
So you have an inherent failure within the system, okay, to basically protect your own coins.
Okay. And is the fact that the way that these trading platforms have operated in the past and present, the way that they have their own, they will manage your wallet for you and then you can pull transactions out of it, is that out of necessity, or could these platforms be developed in such a way that you actually have peer-to-peer transactions and you eliminate that risk by not having your wallet?
You can maintain your own wallet.
Okay.
Is that your question?
I'm not familiar with the way the platforms work, so I don't know if it's...
You can maintain your own wallet.
Okay, so were there people that had their own wallets with Mt. Gox that did not lose all of their Bitcoins in the process of it falling over?
You had them in the wallet.
Okay, so basically everybody that had their wallets managed by Mt. Gox lost all of their stuff. Okay.
Not all, but a good majority.
Okay.
I'm not saying that Mt. Gox got wiped out. That's not what we're saying. We're saying is that they lost so much that they could never replace it. You are very vicious with this, aren't you?
No, it's definitely my fault. I was just going to ask, what has...
Really? Okay, what?
What has been happening with the other virtual currencies post Mt. Gox? I mean, have their exchanges also just been quietly shutting down as...
Well, the more and more exchanges are opening up. I mean, we're talking about Bitcoin exchanges. There are still a lot of Bitcoin exchanges operating. Ripple just came out about a year ago. There are exchanges being opened there. Bitcoin basically stated, hi, you can take your Bitcoins and find a way and you can translate it to US dollars. Ripple basically sat there and said, well, we're gonna do one step better. I love the ears. The ears are moving in front of me. You people don't see this. It's like, you know, my wife's here. You know, the ears and I, what can I say? But Ripple basically has stated that instead of US dollars only, we'll allow you to exchange it for euros. The exchanges are still opening. And more exchanges are going to open every day. All right? The thing that is starting to happen is that the exchanges that are based in the US are moving out of the US.
Uh-huh.
There are also issues that some of the new exchanges in Europe and in Asia are no longer taking US deposits. That is because there's something called FACTA, and FACTA basically says that if you are a foreign bank or a foreign exchange unit, and remember, virtual currency, you're exchanging it, so they're exchange, then you, the institution, have to register with the IRS, good old USA, and sit there, and you, the foreign entity, the foreign exchange, must give us the identity of every US deposit in your depository in your bank.
That's an new law.
That's a new. That's a law that has been in place for 4 years and is finally active, going to be active as of July of next year. And what is happening is quite a lot of countries have signed up for this law. And what is happening is the banks have basically, I know more about the banks than the exchanges in this regard, have basically been throwing out U.S. depositories. Just throwing them out, saying, we're not going to abide by the IRS standards. And the exchanges are having the same problem. So they're doing the same thing.
Peter, you meant, yeah, over here.
Oh, there you go.
You mentioned the world that exists in Tor and Onion sites, and one of the things that exists a lot there are sites that launder bitcoins, allegedly being able to take bitcoins and move them anonymously through the system and get you in and out of that. What factor, if any, does that play, or do those markets play in this entire affair? The laundering.
Well, no, I understand. Well, the laundering basically goes back to Silk Road.
Yeah.
Okay? And the laundering pretty much, Silk Road is now being investigated. All the exchanges are now being investigated to see if they had any connection to Silk Road. Not Son of Silk Road, but, you know, Silk Road 2.0. It's Silk Road for all intents and purposes. The Department of Treasury has gotten support by every country in their investigation. And the laundering of bitcoins to get the currency in, to get out, and get it to the U.S. is pretty much, it's still being done. I'm not saying it's not being done, okay? But more sooner than later, it's going to be found out who you used, and once they find out who you use, they'll trace you out. Okay, I mean, Silk Road basically said, you know, we're using Tor, nobody's gonna find us, and the IRS and the Department of Treasury subpoenas are flying out the door.
One other thing I thought was kind of fishy was that Mt. Gox basically tried to blackmail the other exchanges, saying, hey, you know, we lost this money, if you don't help us cover it, then you know, your coin value is going to decrease as well, which seemed kind of fishy.
I have heard that that's what they did. I've read it on some of the websites about it. But you don't find anything in the filing of the bankruptcy court that that's what they said that they did. So to me, it's kind of like, is it true or not? I mean, even if all the exchanges went and started to jump in and try and help them out, where's the benefit to the other exchanges? They're all in competition against each other. You know, that why should, no offense meant, why, if I'm profitable and honest and making good money, why should I give you, an entity that obviously lost $470 million, some of my money to basically make up for your mistake? The issue was that as soon as really what hit the money value was when, at that time, it would have been Marcus, no longer was buying. And Marcus basically bought $17 million worth of Bitcoin that they can identify and never paid a penny for it. They just switched it into its wallet.
You'd also mentioned Ripple. There's also Stellar. Both of them replaced the blockchain with proof of work with consensus. Do you think that helps in any way? Of maybe bringing more reputable institutions in.
No. Okay. Wait, hold it. I'll think about that for a second. No, okay. I'm sorry. Yes.
Okay, one of the exchanges, which as far as I know is US-based, is Coinbase,
mm-hmm.
which seems to have some fairly reputable backing, at least apparently.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about that?
They're the ones that got $75 million. Coinbase was the entity that basically entered into the agreement with Mt. Gox to basically handle all the U.S. transactions. They were the ones that refused to get the Department of Treasury license for being an exchange. They still do not have a Department of Treasury license to be an exchange, yet they are still exchanging money. I think they're the next hit on the. I think they're the next. If you're an exchange and the Department of Treasury says you're an exchange and you have 90 days, and you're not doing anything, I think you got a problem.
Okay, and the other thing, as far as whether it's money laundering or not, is something like this outfit or website, Local Bitcoin, supposedly matches up buyers and sellers, where someone, you meet up with someone, you know, generally physically, and they give you dollars, you give transfer them some bitcoins.
And they're getting paid as a service to put two people together.
Or at least in theory, though.
Well, I mean, yeah, we're talking
theory. That doesn't always work.
Right. I mean,
right.
Theoretically, you go to this website, I want to sell, they'll hook you up with a buyer, and if the transaction comes about, or it may be an upfront fee, I get paid something. Are you asking me, is the fee legal? I mean, yeah, they can charge you.
I mean, the basic process for the buyer and the seller.
The basic process of the buyer and seller is you can buy and sell bitcoins anytime you want, all right? The issue that you need to recognize is you can buy it, you can sell it, but you're supposed to declare it on your tax return if you're in the United States. Well, you know, you don't have to be a citizen. You can be a resident alien.
If you're a citizen outside the country, you still have to.
Well, that's a U.S. citizen, right. But you could be a resident alien here, and the EU also has taken the position that if you're buying and selling bitcoins, it's taxable. Pay your tax. And I'm not sure about Asia, to be honest. I know Malaysia basically will tax anything they get to get their hands on. Right, dear? Yes, okay. Okay.
I had a question to go back, actually, a few questions concerning the IRS. The new law with IRS, how are they planning on enforcing that? Because you said that was a problem over in Japan on how they would have to find a government that would be compliant with the IRS.
Japan's already signed the treaty.
But I'm saying as far as like other countries, you know, why wouldn't they just move to a country that's not compliant? Or what would keep people from moving to a country that's not compliant?
The problem is, first of all, it's a treaty between the de facto treaty, which makes the financial institutions register with the IRS, is treated a treaty between countries, okay? And every country wants this because the other side of the treaty is that every U.S. institution has to also disclose to that country their foreign depositories that are keeping money in the U.S. So every country, it's a problem with every country where they have nationals putting money in another country, okay, and not inherently paying taxes for that. So it's a benefit to the both countries, okay? If you want to do business in the U.S., you're going to have to sign up. If you don't want to do business in the U.S. and you're doing business in your country, that's great. But the issue comes about if you're also a bank, if you're only a bank that deals in your own, a local community bank, you don't care, okay? But if you're an international bank or a very large national bank, you care because right now it's U.S. and country, okay? But they're becoming bilateral and trilateral countries, so what you're having is you got U.S. who's agreeing with France, who's agreeing with Japan. So now all three of those countries are tied in and have to disclose. And you take a look at your depositors, because that's where you make money, where you basically pay your depositor 0.5% interest and you're loaning the money out at 22%. I mean, that's how they make money. And if you start losing all these depository accounts, you're not going to make any money. So it's a cost compliance issue. That's all it is. Who's got the cube?
I got it. Most financial advisors would advise you to have a mix of stocks and bonds and big caps, small caps, and precious metals, cash.
Yeah.
Wouldn't a diversified portfolio also include some virtual currencies going forward?
I see nothing in speculating or investing in virtual currency as long as the currency is secure. I have strong reservations, like any financial advisor would have, of taking 100% of your life savings and putting it into one item. And that's one of the issues that happened, was that certain people took 100% of their life savings and put it into Bitcoin and lost it all. So as long as the coinage, the virtual currency is safe, It's speculative. Who's got the cube? Somebody's got the cube.
I love the cube idea, by the way. Have you noticed that?
How does the Department of Treasury view the applicability of the Bank Secrecy Act to Bitcoin exchanges?
The banks, as long as the banks follow the Department of Treasury regulations on who is allowed to use and deposit in the banks, they are totally fine. Okay? The issue that you need to understand is the Department of Treasury in regards to banks' secrecy is you can be secret with everybody else but us, the government, so that we can go in and say to you, give us a list of all your depositors, all their names, all their addresses, and everything.
And exactly how much money they deposit
at any point in time. Well, they can get their log, which would be how much in, how much out, which is a requirement. And if you meet that requirement, you have bank secrecy. If you don't meet that requirement, then you're in violation of the Department of Treasury rules and regulations. Therefore, you can't say, I have bank secrecy, because it's a part, it's a component of, if you do A, B, and C, you get bank secrecy. If you don't do A, B, and C, you don't get bank secrecy. And that's how the government looks at these exchanges. You're not doing what's required, therefore you don't have it. And therefore, we're going in. And they go in. Who's got the box? The only thing is, it should have like a balloon or a flag to know where the box is. Yes.
I realize this is a little bit of a broad question, but how do you feel about Bitcoin as far as the viability of the currency?
I think Bitcoin is viable. As long as someone is buying and someone is selling a tangible product using Bitcoin, it's viable. If you ask me, is the valuation of Bitcoin at this moment a true market value? Maybe. You know, I can't sit there and say it is or not. It's what the market is willing to bear, which is one of the basic components of Bitcoin. The market is setting the price, not a governmental agency.
Well, you know, you're a forensic accountant, so I'm sure you can attest to how much a currency actually has value versus what the speculated value for it is. Do you feel that Bitcoin is something in its current state that has lasting value to it?
Bitcoin has lasting value to it as long as somebody wants it.
But all right?
I understand. You see, I don't look at Bitcoin as a currency. I look at it more as a stock or a bond, okay, or an investment or a piece of gold, to be honest. I mean, and literally, as long as somebody wants to buy gold and sell gold, it has value. What's the value? Whatever the market wants to set for it. Okay. That we call it a virtual currency, you know, that's fine. But if nobody wants it anymore, I mean, what was it? Linden Dollars? Something? I mean,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Linden Labs, right? I mean, that was a real big thing, you know? And you could buy virtual real estate. Some people made real money doing that.
Leave online, too.
Yeah. Now, you know, it's like worthless. Well, not worthless, but I'm sure Linden Labs would disagree with that. But, you know, pretty much in the worthless arena, if I could call it that. Yes.
So if someone were to hypothetically set up your exchange on, let's say, an offshore oil rig, and to do that, you'd need like a network of satellites so that you could constantly have internet. But let's say you had the $7 billion to set that up.
Okay.
If you set that up, couldn't you get around the whole Treasury requirement in the first place?
Are we saying that you set it up?
No.
Okay. Well, no. But because there are cases, I mean, let's go into some real humor, and it's an analogy, and you're going to have to run with it, and I apologize. The first online casino was set up by four guys, U.S. citizens, and they set it up in Gibraltar. Gibraltar had no exchange, nothing. They're over there. They stated that they, you know, and they were racking the money in, and it was online, and you were gambling, you have such a great time. And then basically one of them decided to come visit his mother in the United States, and the feds were waiting there, and they put him basically in jail because there's something called the Wire Act. No, you don't get around it. The issue that you have is that if you take U.S. depository money on your oil rig, okay, you have a problem. How are you doing a U.S. transaction with U.S. citizens? All right? So the question is, how do you get around the U.S. current? Because your biggest thing is, I'm going to give you bitcoins, I'm going to sell you bitcoins, but at the end of the day, because you're an exchange, I will find a way to take your bitcoins and I'll send you U.S. dollars. And as soon as you send those U.S. dollars through the wire, you're in violation of the Wire Act from a U.S. tax perspective as interpreted by the government.
Okay.
So don't invest your money into an oil rig. Oil maybe, but not the rig. Right. Or Louisiana, I think, is short refineries. That might be a better deal. Yes?
All right. Well, given we know that Bitcoin is continually progressing despite the setbacks we've been talking about.
Absolutely.
I had a question about other cryptocurrencies that are, you know, using the Bitcoin value, such as, I don't know, Zeta Coin or any of the other ones. Right. How do you foresee the progress of those currencies in the future?
As I remember Zeta, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, Zeta basically has pegged their value to a value on Bitcoin. All right. So as Bitcoin comes and goes in value, so does Zeta basically go up and down. If you take a look at it, you take a look at real life currencies that pair currencies to another currency, and the one that I think pretty much everyone knows about is Mexico. Mexico peso is based on the dollar. In fact, you enter into a contract in Mexico, it's in dollars. And I think that's where that virtual currency will go, is basically, at the end of the day, it's going to convert over to Bitcoin. Because you're using Bitcoin valuation. You know, I don't think it's a viable example to use. I'm not saying that they're not going to make money. I'm saying, for a long-term basis, I don't think it's viable. We got somebody in the back, and we got a bit. Oh, there's the box. I thought you were holding the box.
I apologize for my ignorance of understanding the technology. I wanted to ask what the impact of mining you think with Moore's Law may have on the value of Bitcoin over long term. Also wanted to understand, when you're mining, are you taking someone else's coin, or are you just striking on a chain that randomly exists in the system? And in that case, isn't it possible to randomly strike on one that is actually in possession?
Okay. First of all, mining is not going to do the amount of mining in regards to Bitcoin that is going to go out in the overall thing is not going to do anything to the valuation. Your question is, can you mine? Yeah, I mean, when you mine and you get your Bitcoin or fractional aspect of it, it's a new ID on a Bitcoin. It increases the circulation of the Bitcoin. You're not eating up somebody else's Bitcoin.
Creating one.
Yes. We'll go under creating one, and it's a safer thing. Trust me, it was 2 hours and many, many drinks last year when they were explaining this to me. I like creating much better than what they ran down my throat last year.
Do we have enough time for one more question?
Yes.
Do we have enough time for one more question?
Two more questions?
Yeah, and if I talk quickly, I'll do that.
She had one first.
All right.
Can you wait? Okay.
You've had to.
Yeah. You got kind of an arm there.
Yeah.
Jeez. That's all right. So you were making a comment here about the currency. I mean, typically when you're pegging a currency to another currency, that currency is generally backed by some stable unit. Most of them go for the U.S. dollars because it's supposed to be by the gold standard. You look at and
we're off the gold standard.
I know, but you know what I mean. That it's typically it's backed by to keep it with.
It's backed by the U.S. government.
It is, but to have a current value, right, and a stable value. When you look at some of these other virtual currencies that are going and pegging to
something like Bitcoin that doesn't have a stable value to it, to me, that's where you start having the problem with those items, because there's no stability within the Bitcoin as a standard. Does that make sense?
Right. No, I do understand what you're saying. The issue, though, is let's use the dollar. Is the dollar really worth a dollar? And where is it worth a dollar? Okay? Because even though it's the standard, that doesn't mean that's its inherent value. Okay? And that's the same thing with Bitcoin. Bitcoin is saying, we are basically saying we're not going to use the standard, which the government is setting a price for. We are going to let the market state what the standard is. All right? Does the market fluctuate for virtual currency? Yes. Does the market fluctuate for US dollars, euros? Of course it does. That's how currency traders make a lot of money. So there's a fluctuation in value, no matter what.
But I'm just kind of looking, like, going down the Venezuela, looking at some of your Latin American countries
that have very, very large fluctuations. They're just going to one, and they're trying to peg, like, trying to make a little bit of price, right? So that they kind of do a fluctuation. Right. I understand about the fluctuation and how they want to peg, but if you can take a look, one of the best things you can take a look at is, if you want to talk 1990s, right?
Yeah.
I believe that the French franc, before it became a euro, devalued 8 times by the French government. So people that were pegging to the French franc, right, as a standard, the French government at a point in time had to devalue it. So it's not, I understand what you're saying. One is government standard versus free market. Okay, the government standard is not as reliable as as people like to believe. It just sounds nice. The market can be manipulated. We all know the market can be manipulated. So both of them have inherent economic structural issues. Okay, which one's better? Right now, you know, the government currencies seem to be winning out, but that doesn't mean virtual currency may at a future period.
Will there be a point where mining becomes more expensive than the potential output of Bitcoin?
No, there will. I don't think so. I think what will happen, and I believe it will happen at a period in time, is that you will no longer be able to mine, because Bitcoin will, assuming they don't expand the currency circulation, that it will stop. And once they supposedly hit their maximum currency circulation number, it's supposed to stop, and mining is supposed to stop, because you can't mine something that you can't get issued.
Yeah,
okay,
but
right now
it's expensive.
Hmm?
It's pretty expensive, hardware intensive. To get the hardware, it's exceedingly expensive to be able to get anything out of mining.
It's all set by the mining rate.
Yeah. It's your mining rate.
More miners, the more expensive it gets.
Exactly.
If the miners quit mining, then you can mine more.
But the perception is that mining is a way for you to get money, because a lot of people when they first hear about Bitcoin and hear about mining Bitcoin, they go, well, I could do that, you know, my cheapo computer. So the total processing power expands, and with that discrete number gets larger the more users you have.
True.
And with that, because the amount you get out of mining is dependent upon your total processing power compared to that discrete number.
The original conversation that came up when this whole protocol was developed. You're going back to your day one conversation.
Right. And I think one of the issues you got to realize is, I have a cost creating Bitcoin, but when I create it, I have to also state what is the value of Bitcoin.
Yeah.
All right. So theoretically, if it costs me $600 to mine one Bitcoin, using an example, and Bitcoin's selling for $1,000, I made a profit.
Yeah.
I only make a profit when I get the Bitcoin, though. Yeah. So I have an out of pocket layout. If Bitcoin drops to $1, you got a problem. You can let him go.
Oh, fine.
And then we're out of here.
So going back to mining, you say that you need to report your income to the IRS. I do taxes.
So do I.
One of my customers is actually a Bitcoin web hosting company.
Cool.
So we do their books. One thing that
hasn't come up about reporting all this information to the IRS is, for the miners, reporting your loss, because you got to report how much it costs you and deduct that from how much you made.
No.
So if I spend $1,000 to create $1,000 worth of bitcoins, mm-hmm. it's a wash.
No, it's what you have is you have $1,000 of a cost which you're going to have to prove and allocate that 100% of that went for the $1,000 bitcoin that you got. All right. What you have usually is a currency fluctuation, which is how the government, because what you have is the problem that you're going to have is that from a tax perspective, okay, the cost that you're getting to create this inventory, okay, you've just created an inventory item. That's all it is. Because if you're mining, you're in the business of transaction. So if you basically create an inventory and you now have $1,000, so it's not. They basically take the cash. You're picking up the income. So you have an inventory item of $1,000 and you also have income of $1,000.
And then I have a cost that I had to pay on the electric bill to mine it.
Which you're deducting.
Right, that's what I'm saying. People don't look at the deducting side. They just look at how much Bitcoin do you have.
Right, but that's
on as much tax on it. But wait a minute, it cost me to make that.
But if you have a typical transaction of, since you're doing a web transaction, all right, is that if you basically have 5 Bitcoins that you mined, okay, and you have a cost there of $200 a Bitcoin, so now you have $1,000 worth of value, and you go out and buy a $10,000 TV, you now have a $9,000 profit, all right? And the problem that you're having is that Bitcoin web companies that basically do mining, right, are being requested just like eBay or PayPal to basically send 1099s to these people because it's under the 1099 exchange. You know, you're in bartering almost, and I'll make you a bet your company's not doing it. They're not sending.
No, it isn't my company. They're paying me in cash.
Which I did not hear.
Which I report.
Okay.
Because I'm an LLC.
Throw that one out there real quick. Thank you. I am saying to you that as their accountant doing their tax books and records, you should be telling them they have a compliance problem that they should be filing 1099s. And whether they do it or not, you know, if you're issuing financials, you know, not just tax return but financials, then you have to basically put a note saying they're out of compliance on a certified audit.
Okay, everybody, that's it for questions. This panel's over, and I hope you have a nice night.